The first thing we had to learn was that if we're going to be successful at this, we can't design the process because it makes sense to us. We have to design the process so that it serves the individual we have working. And that, I say today, is the necessity that was the mother of our invention. That's the thing that has kept us honest all these years.
Hi, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Swan.
And I'm Tracy O'Rourke.
We are from GoingSixSigma.com, and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast, where we bring you fabulous apps, polls, news, books, and people so you can build your problem-solving muscle.
Do we get to have cafe corretos again?
Only if we speak Italian, Tracy.
Okay, barboncino.
Tracy, I think you just said poodle.
I definitely don't want a poodle for breakfast. Okay, no shots in my coffee this time, but I'm taking a muffin. Meet you in our private dining room.
Meet ya.
Okay, Elizabeth, what's on our menu today? Is it the diet menu, the kitty menu?
Tracy, it is all the gluten you can eat paired with skinny margaritas. Actually, it's a steady diet of fun facts and enlightenment. But I think you want specifics, so this episode we get to hear your interview with Tom Root. He's the managing partner for Zingerman's Mail Order, which you and I toured recently, and he's a COO for the larger community of Zingerman's businesses, and he has great stories to tell about the trial and error that got his team to stellar performance. For an appetizer, we'll cover a presentation app with Zing. In the news, this time we'll discuss what's coming up with Lean Frontiers in Jekyll Island, Georgia at the end of September, and this month's book is called Understanding A3 Thinking, a go-to reference book for this one-page problem solver. Park your car, come hang out with Tracy and me for a fantastic day at the cafe.
Remember to stay tuned for this month's coupon code in order to get a discount on GoLeanSixSigma.com online training.
Let's get to that appetizer.
So what's this presentation app with Zing, Elizabeth?
It's not a new app, but for anyone who's unfamiliar with Prezi, it's worth describing it or trying it. It's always a bit tough to do justice verbally to something that's completely visual. But another reason I want to talk about it now is that they've made some updates with Prezi, and Prezi does more now. So first off, if you've never seen it or heard of it, it's presentation software that is an antidote to what they call death by PowerPoint. So it may not be the venue for your storyboard, but it could be a way to introduce a topic, to introduce process change, or to present the look of things to come when you do implement process change. Anything that you could do with a dose of energy or pizzazz or innovation. So when you want to create some buzz, here's my description. Prezi lets you zoom in and zoom out of a big single canvas. First, you can focus on a block of text, or you can focus on a set of images or a chart or video. You can fly across the canvas to other text images. You can also, you know, zoom out and see the entire canvas or zoom in and see some detail. So I would use adjectives like surprising, dynamic, engaging. And I would say it's good for when you want viewers to be excited or intrigued. And you can collaborate with others. There's like a built-in texting feature. It works on cell phones. It works on tablets. A cool aspect of their premium version is that it's got analytics. So you can track viewers. You can see where they lingered on your presentation or where they dropped off, and then you can make adjustments. So it lets you fine-tune your content. The pricing for this is subscription-based, so it's $7 a month for personal version, $19 a month for a plus version, and $59 a month for premium. So if you're looking for pizzazz in your presentations, this is it. And Tracy, I know you have a slightly different attitude about Prezi. Why don't you tell our people?
Well, I have to be honest and say that when I first was introduced to Prezi, it was as a viewer. And I didn't like it because I get carsick and the movement on the screen gave me an unexpected, undesirable effect on me. So at first I was a little thrown, you know, you kind of have this expectation that you're going to die by PowerPoint and then you get carsick. No, I do think, though, it is a creative tool for people to mix up their presentations. It does move away from the standard and static PowerPoint presentations that people really get stuck in. And because of the graphical and pictorial nature of the tool, I think it does help people focus more on images and less on words, which is always good for a presentation. So, you know, death by PowerPoint, in my opinion, is because people spend too many slides with too much text, and they're not using pictures and describing things well enough. So I really think that this can be a game changer for people if they have to actually present in a different way. So if you're game for mixing things up, you should try it and give your audience a gift or Prezi with Prezi.
Nice. I'm Elizabeth Swan, and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. Up next, it's Lean Six Sigma in the news. So, Tracy, what is happening with Lean Frontiers? And can you tell our listeners, who is Lean Frontiers?
So Lean Frontiers is an organization that puts on some really awesome events that are specific to process improvement. And I had the pleasure of attending the Lean Coaching Summit last month, hosted by Lean Frontiers and LEI in Seattle. And it was a really great conference. Lean Frontiers does a really great job putting on exceptional events. And if you are in HR, accounting, or finance, have we got a conference for you? This September, Lean Frontiers is hosting their Lean Accounting and HR Summits in Jekyll Island, Georgia, on September 20th and 21st. The Lean Accounting Summit has long served the accounting community by exploring accounting's role in measuring and motivating the lean enterprise. And the goal of this summit has been to better align accounting and operations inside of an organization. And the HR Summit is designed by HR practitioners for HR practitioners. So this is the place for HR professionals to learn lean and their role in supporting it. They've got a great lineup of speakers, including lean legends like Karen Martin, Karen Ross, Cheryl Jekyll, and Gene Cunningham. So for more information, go to the leanfrontiers.com website and you should go.
Yeah, you should go.
I'm Tracy O'Rourke and you're listening to the Just in Time Cafe podcast. In a short while, we'll get to hear my interview with Tom Root, the managing partner of Zingerman's mail order business. But first, it's the printed page. So what do you think makes this book such a go-to reference guide, Elizabeth?
Good question. It is as small as last month's book, and it's probably equally powerful in the way it can change behavior. So this month's book is the Shingo Prize-winning Understanding A3 Thinking, a Critical Component of Toyota's PDCA Management System by Duard Sobeck and Art Smalley. It came out a decade ago. But it's still a go-to reference for a lot of people when it comes to using and understanding the A3. So it's a really helpful summary of PDCA. That's the Plan, Do, Check, Act method. It makes good use of references with solid, reliable sources. The authors explain misconceptions of what they call the Western interpretation of the word standard. There are helpful summaries at the end of each chapter. They provide A3 building exercises for the reader, which is kind of a nice addition, right? You can do your own activities and explore and experiment on your own. There's lots of practical advice. There are tons of detailed and helpful real A3s. There are honest glimpses of the realities inside Toyota, at least what was going on 10 years ago. They include a section on the digital versus the paper debate, and that's about how to fill in the A3. I think the reigning wisdom is use a pencil, but you should check out their debate there. They describe some elements of good or proper visuals, and they have great instruction on how to ask for and give updates on projects, which is just kind of an essential piece of what this tool is used for. So what do you think, Tracy?
I think if you are a learner and you want to learn more, this should be on your book list. Okay, it's time to announce the coupon code.
This code is for 20% off any of our Lean Six Sigma training and certification courses. So that's white, yellow, green, black belt training, and lean training.
So if you've joined us at the Just in Time Cafe, just use coupon code 20DONUT. Don't eat 20 donuts. Just use the coupon code. That's 20% off. That's 20DONUT during checkout. Make sure to use it soon since the coupon code will expire at the end of September 2018.
Coming up next is today's special. Tracy, give us a little preview of your interview with Tom Root.
Yes, I will. So we had the pleasure of going to Zingerman's mail order business in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And this business was highlighted in Jeffrey Liker and Karen Ross's new book, The Toyota Way to Service Excellence. We had the pleasure of meeting Tom Root, the managing partner who took us on the tour. He's a very engaging and entertaining man, and he embodies the ultimate lean leader, what every organization building a lean culture deserves to have, really. He's humble, he's grateful, he has a lot of insight about his journey and some of the lessons learned along the way. I think you're going to enjoy this interview a lot. You're listening to the Just in Time Cafe. I'm Tracy O'Rourke, and joining me today is Tom Root, managing partner of Zingerman's Mail Order and also CEO for the larger community of Zingerman's businesses. How are you today, Tom?
I'm fantastic. Thanks, Tracy.
Well, thanks for coming to the cafe to share some of your experiences as a leader embracing lean. I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about Tom and Zingerman's Mail Order before we get started, and please chime in at any time, Tom. So Zingerman's Mail Order, located in Ann Arbor, Michigan, receives and ships high-quality artisan foods through the United States. You have a crew of about 100 employees, but that workforce grows up to about 400 for the holidays when 50% of their yearly revenue occurs, which is pretty amazing. Can't wait to hear about how you do that. And then also, Zingerman's Mail Order is featured in the Jeff Liker and Karen Ross's newest book, The Toyota Way to Service Excellence, as a model organization for lean in a service environment. No pressure, Tom. You're a model organization in a book.
Right.
So I had the pleasure of visiting Zingerman's Mail Order this May. And so I want to tell you a little bit about Tom. Before you went to Zingerman's, you were a web developer for Detroit Edison, and then you ended up working for Zingerman's. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I had gotten involved in the internet and web development very early on, and actually was planning on making a move during the dot-com boom to San Francisco. And my then girlfriend, now wife, was working at Zingerman's Delicatessen. And there was an opportunity to go out there for a food show. So she went out there under the pretense of the food show, and I went out there to interview for jobs. And we had told our families we were moving to the West Coast, and we were ready to go. And when we got out there, we heard someone give a presentation about running a food mail order company, but doing it on the web, doing it online. And this was, e-commerce was a foreign concept at that time. That was a brand new idea, as it were. And in that moment, sort of hit upon the idea of, let's not move to California, let's stay in Ann Arbor and open up Zingerman's.com. Now, Zingerman's already had a mail order business at that time, but it was only a print catalog and a fulfillment company, and there was no immediate plans to offer a website. And so we came back and we pitched the idea, and one thing led to another, much to the early dismay of my wife, because she had already started packing. We had given notice. I mean, we told the family and the whole thing. But instead of doing all that, we sort of pitched the idea of opening up Zingerman's.com. And in September of, 1999, Zingerman's.com, the first e-commerce Zingerman's property, opened up. And the way it worked was we basically subcontracted all the fulfillment to the existing mail order company, and then we just managed the website. And we did that as a separate business for about 3 years before it became obvious that it made sense to merge the two together. And that's how we ended up being involved in the now Zingerman's Mail Order Company.
Oh, wonderful. So I also saw that you were introduced to Lean around 2004. And then you've been really implementing Lean since then at Zingerman's Mail Order. So give us a little background and some history about how Lean got started. I'm sure people are wondering about the connection and how you were highlighted in the book as well.
Yeah, well, it shows that the best chance at success is to put yourself in a position of opportunity, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So mail order was a pretty traditional fulfillment operation in that we did a lot of batch processing. We make gift boxes and baskets, and we would make those gift boxes in a batch style. If I needed 100 of some gift box, I would put out 25 boxes. I would put product, you know, all the bread in all the boxes, then all the brownies in all the boxes, and all the cheese in all the boxes. And we kind of built things that way. That was problematic, we now see in retrospect, for two reasons. One is that it took up a lot of space to make them, right? 25 boxes sitting there open. And then it took a lot of space to store them. So now I have 100 of these gift boxes. I have to put them somewhere. So our process in those days was to make the gift boxes at night. This is during our holiday time. Uh-huh. Make the gift boxes at night and then pick and ship them during the day. And as a result of that, and the fact that we were very fortunate to have a lot of growth, we were growing 25, 35% year over year, we had actually had to pick up the business and move it 3 times in the previous 6 years.
Wow.
Right. That was gut-wrenching, I think would be the proper term for that. And we were rapidly approaching growing to a size where we thought we were going to have to pick up and move again. And we had actually just bought a building this time. So we were not renting, but had bought the building. And the prospect of moving suddenly seemed very, very, very unappealing. Mm-hmm. But we just didn't know how to do it any different. And it happens that one of my partners, Mo Frechette, was getting his MBA at U of M, and he had gone through an operations engineering class. And in that class, they had been introduced to this book called The Toyota Way. Some of your listeners may have heard of it.
Oh, just a few.
and so he sent me a copy of the book. He said, there might be something to this as in terms of solving our problem. And when I read it, I'll say it this way. I'm sure it was far more subtle than this. But to me, it was like that lightning bolt, that aha moment. Like, yes, this is going to solve the problem. Uh-huh. But we didn't know how to do any of it. And so we saw the name Liker on the book, and we were talking about it at a staff meeting. And one of our service stars, these are the people that work in our service center, said, I think we have a client in our database named Liker. let me take a look. And so sure enough, we looked it up, and here's this Dr. Jeffrey Liker who lives in Ann Arbor. Well, that's where we are. So we found out that he was actually a U of M professor. I called him up and I said, Dr. Liker, we're interested in this material. Do you have a student maybe who would be interested in working with us, studying with us, and helping us learn and in return sort of developing themselves? And he says, I think I got a guy. And he introduced us to a then PhD candidate named Eduardo Lander. Mm-hmm. And Eduardo spent the next 3 years with us studying, experimenting, and teaching the crew at Mail Order about lean concepts. We became a chapter of his dissertation, and the very first thing that we did with lean was change the way we made gift boxes. So instead of making them in large batches and then storing them overnight, we started to build them just in time. We built them through flow rather than batching, and that began the journey.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So I had the pleasure, like I said, of visiting your facility, and you've got some pretty amazing applications from the call center to the warehouse and, you know, how you actually grow. What do you call it? You call it the production, it is the production line of building it, but I think you have a special name for it.
Well, production floor, warehouse, there's a lot of names for it.
The shopping aisle, I can't remember what it is.
Yeah.
But it was, even seeing it was sort of a crazy concept to say, well, it doesn't actually get bigger, just everything moves faster. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So we have a physical place that is, in the lean parlance, our marketplace for items that we're going to pick and ship to customers. And because we have always been space constrained, a necessary requirement of this marketplace was that we couldn't let it grow 10 times during the holiday. There was just no room for that. So we had to have a technique that would allow us to get 10 times more volume out of it during the month of December than August, but it had to be the same physical size. And anybody who's familiar with the concepts of the water spider, the route runner, replenishment, Kanban, that sort of thing, what we do is we have a series of standard tocks that we run the line at. And those standard tocks have recipes, staffing recipes, route frequency recipes, and so on. And so basically what we do is we take the same physical space, we put more people in it to pick faster, and then we put more people and higher frequency on the replenishment routes. And that way we can retain the same physical footprint for the marketplace, but get 10 times the volume out of it.
Very cool. And so there's a lot of other people in the marketplace, up to 400, 3 times the amount of people as well.
Total staffing will grow to about 400 people during the holiday. Not all those people, of course, will be picking. They'll be spread everywhere in the building. But yeah, we go from about 100 standing crew. We add about 400 for the holiday for a total of about 500 people working over two shifts, about 24 hours a day during the month of December.
Wow. So one thing I remember you talking about when I did the tour was how you transformed the hiring process at Zingerman's Mail Order and what it used to be and now what it is. And you had a lot of great stories, but I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what you guys did to address that problem.
Well, so I think so many organizations might relate to this. You know, you have your primary process. In our case, it was picking and packing gift boxes and baskets. And naturally, we were going to apply lean thinking to that because that's where we had the biggest need. But there are these tertiary processes. There's secondary processes that you don't think about. They're painful, but they're sort of that background pain. They're not in your face. And so you don't think to apply the lean thinking to them, or they happen infrequently enough that you don't think to apply the lean thinking to them. So we had a holiday hiring process, which essentially amounted to an open casting call. We would have 2 days during the month of October, or maybe one in October and one early November, where we would put in an ad in the paper saying we're hiring for the holidays. And it was a full day event, and it was kind of an open house. Come and we'll quote unquote interview you. So the effect was that we would have upwards of 2,000 people line up in front of our building on those days. And then we would take our leadership team, which was, you know, 10 people or so, and we would have them, again, I say, quote unquote, interview those 2,000 people over the course of an 8-hour day. Now, if that process sounds painful for everyone, it's because it is. The people who showed up to be interviewed could wait in line for hours just to have a 5-minute interview. And for the people doing the interviewing, they spent 8 hours straight meeting one person after another every 5 minutes for 8 hours. And so it was a very uncomfortable experience at that level. It was also not particularly effective because at hour 7, I've now talked to who knows how many people at 5-minute intervals, and the kind of feedback that I'm getting on their hiring paperwork is things like, nice. Because as the interviewer, I'm spent, right? So right. Yeah, this person was nice. They smiled, right? They said hi. Those are not really deep, probing insights into an individual on which one might want to make a hiring choice. So we really had a bad process, a lot of waiting, a lot of waste in that process, and it was not effective in terms of really determining if a person was qualified or able to work in our space. So we were going through a value stream mapping exercise where we were learning the concept of value stream mapping, and the instructor asked us to come up with some specific examples we might like to try the value stream mapping process on, and someone said, well, what about the holiday hiring process? And as a result of that work, what we developed was the new hiring process, which is each applicant makes a reservation for a 30-minute window during a hiring day. So we publicize, we're going to be doing intake for the following 4 hours on this day or 2 hours on that day or whatever. So the applicant will make a reservation for a 30-minute window on one of those hiring days. They will come in, and they and only 23 other people will be there during that 30-minute period. There'll be a name tag printed for them at the front desk, and then we'll bring them over to our break room where we'll give them something to drink, something to eat, whatever, and then they're gonna wait there until we bring them into the process itself. So the first visual indicator we have about who came and who didn't come is if there's name tags left on the front desk, right? Mm-hmm. So good visual management right off the bat. If I see a name tag, that person didn't come, I shouldn't expect them. Then a host will call for them in the break room, and they will bring them through a series of skills assessments. So we got away from the interview altogether. The interview was too arbitrary. The interview was too susceptible to bias and that sort of thing. So we got rid of that in favor of, can they do these particular skills that we need? So three skills tests. If you make it through all three, then the fourth workstation you go to, they clap for you. They cheer, yay, because you've been hired, right? That's all it took. If you can make it through the skills test, we want you to come and work with us. And then we have them fill out the employment application, by the way, because what I don't need are 2,000 applications of people I'm not going to hire. So right. That's sort of the right work at the right time, if it makes sense. And then they leave that day in that 30-minute window, they leave knowing where they're going to work, when they're supposed to come back, what their training plan is, et cetera, et cetera. If at any point during that process they might fail an aptitude test, we take them through what we call the no door, which is into a sort of more private area with an exit, with a door to the outside, where we tell them, gosh, based on the your scores on this assessment, it doesn't look like this is going to be a good fit. And then we give them the opportunity to exit sort of privately rather than having to march them back through the public space again. So right. It is better for us. At the end of the day, we have hirees. We don't have a lot of paperwork to process. It is not overburdening to any individual, and it is a much better process for the applicant. They can be in and out in 30 minutes and kind of know what their situation is.
And not have to wait 4 hours standing in line.
Yeah, or more. Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's amazing. And so, and when did you put that in place? How long ago?
That's probably been 6 or 7 years ago now.
That's awesome. So I want to shift gears a little bit and have you talk a little bit about maybe you being a lean leader and some of the things that you could share with our audience. We've got a lot of leaders that call in and like to hear about other leaders talking about lots of things. And one of them is your biggest lessons as a lean leader. Do you have any resonating lessons that you want to share with implementing lean or trying lean as a managing partner or COO?
They both have to do with the people. One of the first lessons that we had to learn and that we adopted was that the process is the problem, not the people. The individuals that we work with during the holiday come from pretty varied backgrounds. It's not uncommon for us to see someone, we're only working for 6 weeks, give or take. So it's not uncommon for us to see someone who has had a very checkered employment history. And so when they come to us, we can't make a lot of assumptions about their skill sets. We can't assume much of anything about what they know or don't know. And that includes things like math proficiency. It includes things like being able to read. It includes things like primary and secondary languages. So the first thing we had to learn was that if we're going to be successful at this, we can't design the process because it makes sense to us. We have to design the process so that it serves the individual we have working. Mm-hmm. And that I say today is the necessity that was the mother of our invention. That's the thing that has kept us honest all these years. So my first observation is we have to design work for the people, not train the people to do the work, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yep. Yes. Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so we have an area on our production floor where we do what we call recombination. For leveling purposes, we might break large orders into multi-parts, but before we ship them, we have to put them back together again. We have a conveyor line, and then we have workstations that are on both sides, left and right, of that conveyor line. When we first set this area up, we wanted to ensure an equal distribution of workload on both sides of this recombining orders. Mm-hmm. And we have every box on our production line is noted by a number sequence. And so we hit upon the idea of using the last number in the sequence and determining if it was odd or even. If it was odd, we would do it on the left-hand side. If it was even, we would do it on the right-hand side. And the people that were working there in August, that was a great solution. Everybody was very comfortable with it, and things went swimmingly. Then came the 1st of December. The first big week, the first big volume where we were actually getting a lot of orders that needed to be recombined, and we were working with holiday staff. And we came over and we found an absolute mess. There were totes, boxes on the wrong side of the line, and it was confusion. There was a bottleneck and so on. So we asked the group that we had working there that day, you know, what's happening? What's the trouble? And after a fair bit of sort of hemming and hawing and a little bit of shoegazing, they acknowledged as a group that they were not really comfortable with the difference between odd or even. Now, I like to say that there are three ways to process this information. The first is you can say, why can't I hire good people? Mm-hmm. You know what doesn't solve the problem, though? Wondering about why you can't hire good people, because the people you have are the people that are there. Uh-huh. The second way you can respond to it is, what's wrong with the educational system? But that also doesn't solve the problem.
Right.
The third is to recognize that this process, however well-intended, is not serving the individual I have working today, and therefore is not the right process. Mm-hmm. And then to adopt a process that serves the individuals that are working.
Wow. I don't think most people would take that third jump at all, which is amazing. It's kind of amazing.
There's the trick, right? That's the trick. So the first bit of thought I have for lean leaders is to recognize that our job as leaders, from my point of view anyway, I believe my job as a leader is to design the work to serve the people I have, not for some theoretical ideal candidate. And that has been a tremendous motivator to us to think deeply and empathetically about the people that we have working and how we want them to work and how we can support them and how we can make them successful.
Wow, that's great.
Now, my second editorial comment about leadership and lean also has to do with the people. So I said in the beginning, it's not the people, it's the process that fails. It's not people that fail, it's the process that fails. But my second thing is, sometimes it's the people. and yes, this is a conflict or a conundrum. But if your listeners who have spent any time dealing with lean at all know that there are some things that are fairly unintuitive about lean that you cannot, as I say, sit in deep contemplation and arrive at this as a solution. It only comes by applying our continuous improvement methodology or our experimental methodology and experimenting with things that seem crazy and they couldn't possibly work, only to discover that they do. But because of the unintuitive nature of much of this, resistance is everywhere. We as in our society, in our culture, we have a lot of feelings about power. We have a lot of feelings about leadership, and we have a lot of feelings about followership. We have a lot of feelings about service. A lot of people confuse service and servant. And so they get kind of hung up in the idea that we're going to try and design this process so that anyone can do it. When I tell you, hey, you know what, your job, I can make your job so anybody could do it. The immediate reaction to that for most people is fear, right? Mm-hmm. Because it means that there could come a time when they're not needed. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of resistance exists. You have a lot of people that take their work very seriously, and they have thought deeply about how to do it. They're not maybe necessarily experimental thinkers, but they're deep thinkers, and they become resistant because the new way is a change, and change is scary. Most people don't have a positive relationship with change. Right. Right. So the first observation about lean leadership, I would say, is it's about the people. We have to design the process to support people. People don't fail. Processes fail. But then my second observation is we have to be very mindful about the people, because they're going to resist, not because they're bad people, but because there's fear, and they've learned that fear from being in lots of bad situations. They have a fear of losing their job. They have the fear of becoming irrelevant. They have the fear of not having gainful employment. They have a lot of fears. And if we're not mindful of those, we can come across very heavy-handed, and the resistance will go underground. And then it's very difficult to deal with at that point.
So you have had a lot of success with implementing lean. How do you reduce fear in your organization? Because you obviously, people are doing it. There's a lot of it happening. So what is it that you're doing as a leader to help reduce fear and keep fear at bay?
Well, so we believe pretty strongly in the notion that standard work is the key to empowerment. So one of the biggest things we do is we work a lot at standardizing the work, documented standard work. We then use the training from within industry instructional methodology to teach those standard operating procedures. And then we basically say, now that you know the existence of the SOP, we're going to let you do you, and we expect that you're going to provide feedback. So the first thing is to make our expectations of them very clear. The second step is to provide them the resources. So that SOP actually does both of these things. What my expectations are, that you will do the job as the SOP defines, and here is a documented recipe or SOP for you to follow. So clarify the expectations, provide the resources. All right. Then acknowledge and reward that performance. Hey, nice job. I see that you're catching on. Your pace is getting better. These are excellent things. Or nice job. You weathered that storm today perfectly. You know, so we're trying to reward and acknowledge that, and then get out of their way, and let them do them. We also expect that they will either meet the expectations or negotiate new expectations. So this is probably where the trust begins to build, which is the counteractor to the fear, is that when they come up with a suggestion, we actually listen, because we believe nobody knows the work better than they do, right? So it's not always that every idea is a good idea, but we're certainly going to take the time to listen to the idea and work with them to develop their understanding of their work so that the next idea is a little bit better. And when we get into a pattern where they see that their feedback is welcomed and considered, and then under the best case scenarios applied, then they begin to see that this is not just a lot of talk, but actually a process that we take seriously. Most of all, one of the things that you can start with, we started with, was the only mistake you can make is not following the SOP. If you follow the SOP and something untoward happens, that is never going to be your fault. And then really living that concept was sort of our ground level. And then that works on the value of the SOP. And then we can build onto that. The idea of improvement to the SOP is everybody's responsibility as well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing. That's really insightful. And I think that that might be something people have never heard before in terms of focusing on the process. Don't force people to do the process. Design the process so it works. I love that.
It's not glamorous stuff, though. I think that's one of the tricks, right? I just told you that one of the keys to our success is this documented standard work. I mean, that's not sexy, right? That's not glamorous. That's pretty dull stuff. But the truth is, that's where the money's made.
Right. Exactly. Well, one of my favorite things about when I visited you was you take us on this tour, and you'd have a lot of visual management, and you would say, this may look like cardboard and duct tape, but it is a highly sophisticated piece of inventory management equipment.
Yes.
And it would be like twine. And, you know, one of my favorite things is the shadow board for building a weekender. So, yes. I mean, that's pretty amazing. It's just a piece of cardboard. So right. These are some very simple things that you've done. And I don't know if there's any visual management techniques or tools that you use that you felt like, wow, that has I'm sure there's a lot of things you could think about and share about visual management that you've put in place, whether it's the call center or the production line. Is there anything that is coming to mind for you?
Well, maybe I'll talk about the process, the thought process that goes into making that stuff. Again, we talked a little bit about, I have a background in software development. There's a concept in software development called paper prototyping. And basically what you do is you build an interface using sheets of paper or whatever. And then when you do some work with potential customers, you literally walk them through. They'll say, okay, show me what you would click on. And they'll touch the piece of paper or the button. And then you go, okay, if you touch that button, then you shift the paper around and you say, this is what you would see. Now, what would you do? And this technique allows us to, in the early stages, it's sort of set-based development. If, again, your listeners are familiar with LPD, lean product and process development, there's set-based design. So you start with lots and lots of options and then you winnow them down rather than starting with one idea and trying to make everything fit into it. So paper prototyping is this technique of getting rapid feedback, very low cost, very fast feedback on a design before you ever try to write software. Mm-hmm. So our approach to visual management and tools and SOPs and that sort of thing in the production space and in the call center is sort of the same thing. The first question we always ask is, when we've identified a need, what is the cheapest, fastest way we could produce this? What can we get an 80% solution, right, in the next, you know, hour? And what we've found is that if we do a good job in that first hour of getting 80% solution, we often never have to go beyond that. Mm-hmm. So one example that you gave was, we were looking for a way to ensure that the right ingredients went into a particular gift box that we were making a lot of. And we didn't want to check the order, right? We know that checking is a non-value added activity. So how can we build the quality in? And someone said, well, you know, it reminds me like my grandfather's tool shop, where the tools all had, they were on the pegboard and they all had outlines. We said, well, that's a cool idea. Let's try that. So someone they ripped the lid off of a cardboard box. They took and laid all the product that meant to go in the gift box out on it. And they drew around, like outlined, like, what is it, a murder scene where you see the body outline on the wall?
Yeah.
It was like a murder scene of product right on this little piece of cardboard. And then we left it there and we said, okay, try this for the day and see, you know, what do we need to change about it? And one day turned into two, and 2 days turned into three, and then 3 days turned into 3 weeks, and then 3 months. And small changes, like we wrote what the product was in the box and so on, and then we finally got a white piece of cardboard versus the brown piece of cardboard. But we realized that we never needed anything more than that. That was a solution that was working all the time in this particular case, and we didn't need to evolve beyond that. That's really been our experience with so many other things that we've done, which are low tech or no tech, is it was just, what can we cobble together? What can we sort of band-aid and bubble gum and rubber band together to test it? And then a lot of times that solution that we cobble together in the first day ends up being a good enough solution, and we go on to another problem.
Right. Well, I think that's amazing, considering you're a software developer, that you wouldn't want to try to automate it. So that's pretty awesome.
Well, it's one of my biggest learnings about Lean is I have become deeply suspicious of technology.
Very good.
Learning is not lost on me, mind you.
So we're almost out of time, and I really want to talk a little bit more about another interest that you have, something that you co-founded, an organization called MakerWorks in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about this interest you have and where you're spending your time when you're not at Zingerman's Mail Order?
Sure. So we've established that I'm a geek. And so Mail Order has been a great laboratory, but I didn't get to do a lot of my geeky stuff by becoming sort of a generalist. And so a couple of years ago, I felt like I wanted to do something else. I wanted to try something different. And I went through the thought process of what would I do if money were not the object. And I had heard about this idea of what's called a maker space. So a maker space is like a tool shop that's run like a health club. So if you think about a health club, it's a lot of equipment, and people buy a membership to have access to the equipment. So a makerspace is the same kind of concept, except that the equipment isn't treadmills, it's metalworking mills, it's not weight benches, it's laser cutters, right? Mm-hmm. So I got involved in learning about what a makerspace was. And the more I got involved in it, the more I recognized that if we take a lean manufacturing facility to its natural conclusion, right now we have lived a long time in an era of mass production, where we have machines and processes optimized to make one of a million things, right? Mm-hmm. One type, but a million of them. That's batch processing as we would know it. Mm-hmm. Lean says that what we should do is have a facility that's prepared to make one of a million different things, right? That's one piece flow.
Right.
So what would a facility that was designed to make one of a million different things look like? Well, it would look like a wide array of tools that could be used in combination to produce lots of interesting things. So a makerspace immediately jumped out at me as sort of the future of the manufacturing facility. Digital manufacturing is making manufacturing a localized thing again. Instead of mass producing washers for the washing machine overseas, spending a lot of carbon, moving that product around, storing it in large warehouses, and overproducing, In the future, we're going to be able to download a digital file from Maytag, which is the legal right to produce one of these washers. I'm going to take it to a service bureau down the street from me, and I'm going to have it produced in a 2-day lead time, and then I'm going to update it, or maybe even produced in a half hour lead time, right? Because the equipment's still there. Mm-hmm. So that service bureau to me looks a lot like a makerspace. It's a facility, again, prepared to make one of anything. Mm-hmm. So I got really excited by the makerspace concept and wrote a business plan and found some support. And in 2011, we opened up an 11,000 square foot facility that's got everything from electronics through jewelry making, textiles, laser printers, a full wood shop, full metal shop, sandblasting, powder coating, the whole deal. And the idea is to support people trying to start businesses where they are self-sustaining, and this idea of sort of a modern manufacturing facility. Now, along the way, we realized that experiment that we've been running over at Mail Order about designing standard work for people actually had some bearing in the makerspace. Mm-hmm. So the makerspace is actually not dissimilar from my holiday experience, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm going to take someone off the street and I need them to get up to speed and proficient in a relatively short period of time to be a productive contributor, right? Mm-hmm. It's not to contribute to making gift boxes, but it's to be a productive contributor to their own project. And it turns out that standard work and the training methodology and 5S-ing and all these things really, and process design with the person in mind, really support the experience of being in a makerspace. So we've started to write some documentation about how we use lean techniques in the makerspace. Most notably, 5S is a great example. Drawers and doors are the enemy in a makerspace. It's kind of like trying to put dishes away at a friend's house.
Yeah.
After the dinner party. If you walk into a space like that every day and you don't know where everything is, it's not going to feel very productive. So we have to figure out, how do I make it so that they can walk up and feel productive very quickly? So that's how MakerWorks, makerspaces in general, I think, are interesting manifestations of lean thinking.
Wow. And so is it growing? You've had a lot of people coming to this facility and coming to classes?
It's growing. This is my classic field of dreams story. You know, if you build it, they will come. We opened in 2011 and we thought we'd probably have enough members to be happy within 18 months to 2 years. It's taken more like 7 years, but it's still a labor of love and we're still doing it.
Well, I think it was really enjoyable talking with you. We're out of time now, and I'm really bummed because I could probably spend another hour just talking with you. I think what I appreciate most about talking to you is you're pretty high in the organization, but you are so knowledgeable about lean and so invested and ingrained and rolling up your sleeves. You really can feel and hear, you know, how you've been involved in this. And I think that that's a tribute to other leaders. I think sometimes leaders feel like they don't need to know about some of these things. And then they just say, well, that's something other people are going to do. And then they don't really engage. And I think you seem to be a great model for a leader, especially learning these concepts.
Well, it's easy when you love what you do.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Tom. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you?
Sure. You know, www.zingermans.com is a great way to find the Zingermans properties. There's email through there. If people are interested in connecting, they can connect through there. And I look forward to hearing people. There's also maker-works.com. That's the tool shop if you're interested in looking at that.
Thank you so much for joining me at the cafe today, Tom. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tracy. Thank you.
Check out this month's Wonder Woman Equality, Dana Wilson. She is the Vice President of Customer Experience Assurance at Comcast Cable, and she has an amazing story. And this month's success story comes from Cape Cod Child Development, where Janelle Clune managed to increase enrollment in their Head Start program, which means kids on Cape Cod and the islands all benefit.
Be sure to catch our next episode, where Elizabeth interviews Aisha Ahmad. She's the Operations and Performance Improvement Leader at Memorial Care in Orange County, California. I had the pleasure of meeting her at the Lean Coaching Summit. And she's a lovely woman. She was born in Libya and raised in Saudi Arabia, went to school in Iowa, and did her post-grad studies at Stanford University Medical Center. What a story.
Thanks for hanging out with Tracy and me at the Just In Time Cafe.
Come back in 2 weeks.